Blog Talk Radio.
God save the Republic. Our fathers appealed to heaven. What did heaven do? Heaven heard. Heaven heard. Our fathers said they would treat all men equal. When they did not, heaven saw. Heaven saw. Our fathers fought each other and paid a great price. Father Abe kept the Union, but not the Republic. We forgot the Republic and placed our trust in man and suffer oppression. We appealed to heaven. What did heaven do? Heaven heard. Heaven heard. God save the Republic.
Years from now, some of them may look back and ask themselves whether they've made the right choice, whether they've made the most of the opportunities they've been given. Together, we have the same mission. Over the course of your life, you will find that things are not always fair. You will find that things happen to you that you do not deserve and that are not always warranted. But you have to put your head down and fight, fight, fight. Never, ever, ever give up. Don't give in, don't back down, and never stop doing what you know is right. Nothing worth doing ever, ever, ever came easy. And the more righteous your fight, the more opposition that you will face. In your hearts are inscribed the values of service, sacrifice, and devotion. Now you must go forth into the world and turn your hopes and dreams into action. America has always been the land of dreams because America is a nation of true believers. When the pilgrims landed at Plymouth, they prayed. When the founders wrote the Declaration of Independence, they invoked our Creator four times. Because in America, we don't worship government, we worship God. It is why our currency proudly declares, "In God we trust." And it's why we proudly proclaim that we are one nation under God. The story of America is the story of an adventure that began with deep faith, big dreams, and humble beginnings. The next generation of American leaders, never, ever give up. There'll be times in your life you'll want to quit. Never quit. Never stop fighting for what you believe in and for the people who care about you. Carry yourself with dignity and pride. Demand the best from yourself. The more people tell you it's not possible, that it can't be done, the more you should be absolutely determined to prove them wrong. Treat the word impossible as nothing more than motivation. Relish the opportunity to be an outsider. The more that a broken system tells you that you're wrong, the more certain you should be that you must keep pushing ahead. You must keep pushing forward. And always have the courage to be yourself. America is better when people put their faith into action. Pray to God and follow His teachings. Today, each of you begins a new chapter as well. When your story goes from here, it will be defined by your vision, your perseverance, and your grit. You will build a future where we have the courage to chase our dreams no matter what the cynics and the doubters have to say. You will have the confidence to speak the hopes in your hearts and to express the love that stirs your souls. As long as you have pride in your beliefs, courage in your convictions, and faith in God, then you will not fail. As long as America remains true to its values, loyal to its citizens, and devoted to its Creator, then our best days are yet to come. The class of 2017, may God bless the United States of America. And I just want to let you know that God blesses you. And I want to just say, you are special in every way. God bless you and God bless America. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
I think they played fireworks after that. I'm not sure. I don't know. That was one of the older ones. But, hey, all right, everybody. Joseph Gibson here. Say hello to everybody out there. Hello, FBI. Hello, CIA. Hello, ATF. Hello, DEA. Let's see. Who else? TWA, ABC, whatever. You know, all the three-letter organizations out there that are keeping us safe, I guess you could say. You know, let's talk about the New World Order. You know, everyone talks about you know, how we're going to fix things, and, you know, we're going to, everybody has this spirit deep within inside them that they think they're going to fix things, and we're going to make things better, and there's nothing wrong with that, but the thing of it is that there's the number of us that are trying to fix things that care anymore is just, it's just dwindling. One of the people I spoke to mentioned that the numbers in the votes that came out to vote, you know, it, out of all the registered Republicans, out of all the people that can be registered to vote in my county, I think, what do you say, 3,000 or something? I want to bring them on here in a second. You know, it's just nobody's – I remember I was standing at the polls when I ran for office in the primary, and you know, people did not – they didn't even know who to vote for. They didn't even know who the candidates were, some of them. I was a candidate. I'm standing – I'm like, I'm a candidate. Like, oh, you are? They didn't even know. You know, and they're coming to vote mine blindly. Imagine how many people I saw or how many people I didn't see that just went ahead and voted for the wrong people to get into office. And people say, and you know, you've heard me say it doesn't matter anyway who we vote for because most of them are selected. I mean, how can we trust these elections? I mean, you scan your ballot, it goes into a computer, it reads, it gets read on the computer. I wonder if how does that exactly work anyway? It goes into an internet cloud. I mean, how does it work? And they register to tally the votes because when they were tallying up my votes, I mean, the guy, at first I won, right? I got screenshots of everything, and people are going to be on this podcast. We watched the election results come in. First I won, then I lost, then nobody voted for me. And I mean, it was right, it was like 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. Nobody voted for me, not one person voted for me. And then finally they gave the two or three other scenarios, and then finally they came up with the number they wanted. You know, I got the same 20% as I got last time. Actually, I got 1,000 more votes than what I got before in the primary in 2022. So it's that was with this negative media publicity, you know, the Nazi crap that they pulled. You know, so I mean, they didn't want to talk about not one issue. I didn't get one interview about one issue facing the people of the county. They didn't want to talk about nothing in the media. They didn't want to talk about nothing except my past 30 years ago and the not getting me on the ballot. You know, I had to get permission to get on the ballot from the State Board of Elections. I had to get permission, you know. That's how free we are in America. Isn't that nice? And plus, you know, after I paid the filing fee, you got to pay a filing fee, you know, to get your name on the ballot. Now, the position I ran, the seat I was running for was $200-something-odd, or $260-something, I think. If I wanted to run for governor, it would be like $1,700 just to get, you know, to pay. And then they could throw me off, just throw me off the ballot. Yeah, okay. You know, you got to pay to get your name on the ballot. I mean, it's just this. We're not a republic anymore. We're so far from. And then, you know, we go over to history. We talk about it constantly: Reconstruction, Civil War, what the war, you know, the Federal Reserve, and what really controls the economy. Because people really think the president controls the economy. It doesn't. The Federal Reserve controls the monetary policy of this country. I mean, so what are taxes for? Why we have a machine that prints the money? The government just, you know, they come up with these bonds and float them right to the Federal Reserve. Federal Reserve buys them, you know, and on the promise and faith and credit of the United States that we're going to pay it back, they borrow the money from the Fed. Fed prints the money, gives it to the Treasury. Treasury then, you know, buys it up to the states. And, you know, I mean, how else can they come up with all the billions of dollars sent to Ukraine? How much did they send to Ukraine last time? $300 billion? Now, well, how much is it going to be this time? Now they came up with $95 billion, I think. Well, that was between Israel and Ukraine. And then they had to put a bunch of other stuff in there too, right? I mean, it's just insane. But a gentleman I'm going to bring on here tonight, I'm going to let him introduce himself and maybe give his background. We'll just have a conversation, I guess, about, you know, things, I guess you could say, the things that we all talk about every single day and things that we that concern us, and go from there. Let me see here. Let me go check this call board. I know he sent me a text to say he was on there. I think he's here. All right, there he is right there. I see him. All right. Let's see here. Go ahead.
Hey, Joe. Thanks for having me on.
All right, man. How you doing?
Fantastic. What a beautiful spring day.
Oh, yeah. Here in North Carolina, you can't beat this weather now. But it's not going to last long, trust me. It won't be long before it's 100 degrees and it's dry and everything's dying. Can't breathe out there.
The nature of it.
So, can you just introduce yourself, really? I know you called in one other time to the show a few weeks ago, but you didn't get a chance to really introduce yourself. Introduce yourself. Give me some background on you, and just tell me, you know, what concerns you, and really how we made contact, and what, you know, what some of your thoughts and opinions.
Sure, Joe. You want the rundown history or the quick one? Because the rundown history, I think, especially because I'm a recent addition to the area, I'll give a little bit of my history. My parents moved to the East Coast when I was young, about 3 years old. My father felt called into the ministry, and we spent a year traveling across the United States visiting Bible colleges and seminaries. And ultimately settled in Lynchburg, Virginia, back when Liberty University was Liberty Bible College. And my father is a pastor. He's been a pastor for all of his adult life. But I got raised in a household where masculinity and the division of male versus female and what people call the patriarchy today, a mother who stayed at home, a father who worked, and he built men. I'm the oldest of five kids. My parents actually went in front of Congress, state Congress and Senate in Virginia to help get the laws passed to allow home education. So I was one of the first people that was legally home educated in the state of Virginia after all the public school creation and the mandate for that educational system. I moved to North Carolina after I graduated, but I had the opportunity because of... When you're home educated, unlike the public school system where you go to a class for 8 hours and you're led at the speed of the lowest common denominator in the classroom, being in a school of five kids separated by three to four to two years apiece, being the oldest, you get an opportunity to learn at your own pace. And so I graduated from high school when I was 15 years old. Started community college because I didn't have a direct plan for my future. Did that for a couple of years and then went to Liberty University for a year. Met my wife at 16. She was 17. She was a senior in high school and I was a sophomore in college. And she's a year older than I am. We went to Liberty together and ended up having too much time together, and when I found out I was going to become a father, I made the decision to leave university and go into the military. So I joined the United States Air Force, became an aeromedical evacuation specialist, doing helicopter rescues and flight transfers from hospitals. did my service in the military and got out. First job that I got was with Pegasus Air, a flight paramedic service that did car accident rescues and transfers between hospitals. And young father, 24-hour on, 24-hour shifts, pay wasn't great. Had the opportunity, was recruited into a general management program in the freight business, went to work for Consolidated Freightways, and it was like a military job in that you sign up for the program and you do a year training in all the different departments, and then whatever position's open, be it operations or customer service or sales or whatever it is, ended up going to work in the Virginia Beach, Newport News, Hampton Roads area, and my background in the military helped me in the sales business, generating relationships and contacts. And I did that with them until I moved to North Carolina. I got a promotion to a national account manager in 2002. Came to North Carolina, based in Greensboro, and the organization went bankrupt. 29,000 people put out of work in one day. And the reason that's important to the story is because it had a significant change. You know, up to that point in my life, I had grown up with a mentality of everything is about your family. I'd always been a sheepdog. I hate bullies. I'm a big guy. I'm 6'3 and 270 pounds. And when I'm fighting fit, I'm still 250. Like most guys that are medics, we carry other people around and still get to play the game. When the organization went out of business, it was because of bad financing deals. GE Capital called a loan, an operating loan, and 29,000 people were laid off in one day. And it changed my perspective on the way that the business world works. It changed my perspective on the way that individuals are viewed. You know, retirements had started going away. 401k was becoming a thing. And it had an impact on my prioritization of things. Up to that point, I'd been really satisfied doing my job really well. But when I watched the board of directors at that company make millions and millions of dollars in bonuses, and all of the employees were left holding, they were self-insured, so all anybody's medical debts for that entire year came due at 90 or 120 days late. We were put 70 or 80th on the list for the bankruptcy payouts for our last paychecks. My last two paychecks bounced. And so I made a decision at that point that whatever career path I was going to take, I was going to get into leadership, and I was going to be a part of the leaders that were servant leaders, that recognized the value of the people that make their company successful. Luckily for me, I was recruited to DHL, which is an international shipping company. We're actually the largest logistics company in the world. We're larger than FedEx and UPS combined. But here in the United States, we only do international shipping. So from a TV commercial perspective, like everything else on the boob tube, it's pretty false as far as the perspective that we all have based on what's presented to us versus the reality and the things that we deal with from a day-to-day perspective. Promoted through the organization, I spent a couple of years as a program manager doing operation, implementing very large organizations and IT systems and getting things set up, and was promoted through the ranks a couple of times. And had the opportunity to go into an enterprise-level sales role, and one of the businesses that was in my book was the Department of Defense. This is right after 9/11, and the war had really kicked off in Iraq, and it was starting in Afghanistan. And because of my background in the service and the opportunity based on that same mentality, I chose to be a medic because I wanted to help people. And my viewpoint in working with the Department of Defense, which I've now done for almost 22 years with DHL, is that I don't have to agree with the politics of war. That I don't have to agree with the government and the leadership making a decision to send us off to these foreign places to kill our children. But the average age of the service people is 19 years old. And the opportunity for me to provide support and to give them the gear that they need to be able to survive and to make it home to their families, having experienced it myself in places like Bosnia and Mogadishu and other hot spots that didn't make the news all that much, unless of tragedy. That I've had the opportunity now for the last 8 years. I worked my way up through that team. I actually took, I went in 2008. I went, was based in the Kingdom of Bahrain and worked in Iraq and Afghanistan and throughout the Middle East and North Africa and Turkey for 2 years. Transferred from there to Asia Pacific and supported the Indo-PACOM region. At that time, it was just called the Pacific Command. So my territory was everything from Pakistan to Hawaii, Alaska, and Guam, 28 time zones and a whole lot of travel. My family lived in Portland, Oregon, or just north of there, and I commuted to Asia. I'd go over for 2 or 3 weeks at a time, come home for a week. Had the opportunity to move up into leadership of the team, and that I convinced them to allow me to do it from North Carolina. My father was a pastor at a church in Greensboro, and my kids were missing the opportunity to be around their grandparents and their cousins. And we moved to at that time, to Greensboro. And I came back to the area. I'm now the global head of the program, so I work with the Department of Defense, all federal agencies, the United Nations, NATO, World Health Organization. I work with the largest defense contractors in the world. I also work with foreign governments, so the Colombian National Police Force or the Japanese Foreign Affairs Department, the Australian Defense Force. If taxpayers pay for it in the world, that's my responsibility within DHL as an organization. And I've been doing that now for 8 years. When my youngest daughter, who is 21 and a student at University of North Carolina, started up college, and when the election was stolen, which anybody who doesn't recognize that as fact hasn't done enough research, hasn't watched 2,000 Mules or spent any time looking for critical answers. But with the business that I do, you learn a tremendous amount about what's happening in the world. I move millions of shipments a year for the U.S. government and for our allies and for other organizations. And you can tell a lot by what's happening in the world, by what materials and the commodities and how much of that material is being moved. And I recognized when the election was stolen that it was time to get a little bit more space. So my wife and I bought a 23-acre farm in Madison, North Carolina, about 4 years ago, right after the election. And even though we made some steps to give ourselves the ability to be a little bit more self-sustaining and self-reliant, we raise our own chickens and pigs and keep goats as an emergency food source and grow some of our own vegetables. With my work schedule, I don't get to invest as much of that as time in that as I'd like to. But it's changed my perspective on things, and that is that over the course of the last 21, almost 22 years, we moved 11 times, 17 times since my wife and I first got married. We just celebrated our 31st year together. When this latest local election, and I guess that's really where the conversation starts as we get to present, and our first conversation together is, I had not invested in local politics. My entire world was, I present at the Pentagon regularly. I'm in Washington, D.C. all the time. I deal with the lobbyists, and I have met a lot of the, frankly, low IQ people that we've elected into positions because of their personality or the way they look on a camera, what they read off of a script, but not necessarily the investment in the populace. And the national elections are important. But the national government is fairly lost, as you well know. And so the local election here last year, population of 100,000 people in Rockingham County, North Carolina, and 3,900 people bothered to vote. It was a wake-up call for me. It was a recognition that we sit on our couches and we watch the news for those of us that are a little bit more awake, we get all of our news off of internet resources and places like X or Truth Social, Instagram and TikTok to get the variable news that can't be blocked by the media with their narratives. And I recognize that if we don't invest in change in our immediate community, if we don't get people involved, if we don't stand up, who will? And I'm one small person, but I'm trying to make an effort now for the first time to really get involved and invested and building relationships with people in the community, learning about what's happening from a local political standpoint, and trying to create some grassroots efforts to get people invested in investing in their community. Our lives are easy. We live in the easiest time in history, in the greatest country in the world, even with all of our flaws. As Eisenhower said, we have the terrible, corrupt, broken government, but it's still the best in the world. And I believe that's the case, even though it is far gone and we're losing it quickly, that our opportunity to change things has to happen by people getting off of their couches and getting invested in the things that we complain about, actually doing something about them. And so that's what led me to calling into your recent call. We have a group on Nextdoor that's Rockingham County American First, a group on Facebook, and we're starting to build a community. We're actually having our first get-together on May 25th here in the county to bring people together and start having conversations and look at what we can do to get invested and involved, to volunteer potentially from a political perspective. To your point, when I went to vote in the early election, there was a Democrat standing outside of the voting location at the library here in town, but there wasn't anybody else to talk to. I did my research, but while I was there, I watched at least four or five other people come in to do the vote, and they didn't know who was on the ballot, and they were picking the names they were familiar with, which is exactly how we've gotten into the situation that we're in now. And unless we can help wake some people up, not just the people that are at home and sitting on their computers and are awake, but actually get out in the community and start having conversations, we're not going to be able to change anything. And this election is, I think, frankly, the last one that we'll have if the left wins. As far gone as we are,
I agree.
It's time.
I agree with that. You know, and just not to cut you off, but when you're traveling around the world and dealing with these world leaders or these people, that control many of the things that, you know, the shipping portion of what you do, obviously the most important factor to our economy, you know, and the rest of the global economy. See, what we see, how much of it is reality and how much of it is a big fat lie? I think that's what a lot of people would like to know. Is it true what's going on? Is this secret cabal out there that's controlling everything and pulling the strings behind the scenes? And that's really trying to destroy everything, or is that just one big made-up fat lie?
I think that there is reality to a lot of the different versions of what people perceive the deep state to be. I think the most obvious and the one that I interact with the most is the unelected bureaucrats that are in their jobs for a lifetime. Most people don't know this, but if you go to work for the U.S. government or the military and you retire at 20 years, when you leave the military, you can get a federal civilian job, and you only have to work for 15 years to get your second retirement, and then you only have to work 10 years to get your third retirement at full boat pay for each one of those three retirements. And the vast majority of the people working in the government, in the Department of State that I've dealt with embassies all over the world, the U.S. military people, when they retire, they go back to work as civilians, and they utilize those advantages for gaining that additional retirement. And I don't judge any of them. I think that a tremendous amount of the people that join the service do it out of a sense of service and patriotism and an opportunity to invest. People like me that came from a very poor background, my family lived in a two-bedroom apartment with my mom and dad in one bedroom, three boys in a three-tier bunk bed, and my sisters in a custom-built castle out of plywood in the living room as their bedroom. That, for me, going into the service was a way to pay for college, which I didn't ultimately finish until I went to American Military University when I was in Bahrain. So it took me nearly 20 years to finish my undergrad in international business. So back to what you're saying, from a deep state perspective, the politicians are only there as an elected face. When you elect somebody to Congress or to Senate, the staff that works for them, they lose their seat. Half of them will stay to work for the new person, even if it's they worked for a Republican the first time, now they work for a Democrat. They change positions and they switch the people that they work for, but the bureaucrats that work inside of the government, the people who actually write the laws, the ones that are easily influenced by the lobbyists and don't have the legal limitations about taking money that we know gets taken anyway by the elections, they are the ones who actually run the government. The politicians are faceplates, and even the ones that we love to watch on the news, that we have respect for based on the way that they present themselves in front of the cameras, when you actually watch their votes, it's easy to lose heart because they say one thing to get a face on the camera, but they do another thing behind the scenes, and that's not all of them. I'll give you an example. I was at a meeting and Rand Paul came. We had two senators that came to speak to us that day at a breakout lobbyist group. And the first senator showed up in a U.S. government Suburban with two armed security, two assistants, and walked in and did the handshaking and the baby kissing. Rand Paul showed up in an Uber carrying his own bag, came in, did his presentation, had the conversations, and then left in another Uber. When he talks Wow. about his fiscal responsibility and being a libertarian, he really truly is the example that we should be electing to the offices. And I feel for him. He's fighting a very strong uphill battle. But back to the deep state. The World Economic Forum is the financial engine of the elite, the oligarchy, if you will, of our world. The U.S. from capitalism, there is no greater way to generate wealth than a capital society. But as you know, our organizations and our companies have continually sold to each other and merged and sold to each other to the fact that now every radio station, every television station, every news network in the country is owned by five corporations. All five of their CEOs are members of the World Economic Forum. All five of those organizations are more than 10% owned by State Street, Vanguard, and BlackRock. So is the deep state real? Yes, it is. But it comes in a lot of different perspectives. The World Economic Forum, all of the billionaire class are members. The vast majority of them are. The CEOs of the Fortune 1000 are members or want to be members. And they agree on their plans and their strategies. And the reason that I know that is the company I work for is very actively involved in the World Economic Forum and sends leaders from each of the divisions of DHL. We have seven. So we don't just send one CEO. We send seven CEOs to this. I can tell you that the United Nations plan, their 2025 and 2030 plan, is the exact same plan that the World Economic Forum gave to them. Our elected officials in Washington, D.C. are funded by those same billionaires. To answer your question, I think that it's all of the above.
So, and so these people that are these elites that are part of these billionaire club or these elite Wall Street executives, I guess you could say, are they a part of some family clique? Or is, because we always hear about this, the Rothschilds, the J.P. Morgans, the Rockefellers, the Warburgs, you know, they're the ones that are, you know, or the Vatican and or the Zionists, what is that, all of the above too, or is that just, or is there just a tiny few that, hey, they, we all revert back, they got their little inner circle that we, you know, some heads call the shots, you know. I'm sure there's not one guy sitting there pushing all the buttons. That can't be. I just don't see how that could be, but. Is there a group of people that are there that, you know, that just like, and who are they? I mean, if you can, what background do they come from?
Well, I think that it's a combination of factors. I think that if you go to the base of it, the families that have wealth want to maintain that wealth. And in order to maintain wealth, you have to maintain power. Yeah. So there's a driving factor that for those, I'm not wealthy. But I know people who are wealthy, and I, the only thing I fear is God. I don't fear death, mm-hmm. and I don't fear being broke, and I don't fear getting sick. All of those things are just part of life. But every single person that I know who is wealthy fears losing what they have. And the mm-hmm. families at the richest families in the world, they are going to drive an agenda in one fashion or another. We see it with the very evident involvement of somebody like Soros.
Yep.
He's a Jewish man who betrayed his people and collaborated with the Nazis, and he's one of the founders of the World Economic Forum. Klaus Schwab, his father was the CEO of the largest ammo and arms manufacturer in Nazi Germany. He is one of the founders and currently the president and chair of the World Economic Forum.
Wow.
If you get back to the United States government and the rocket programs and Operation Paperclip, when we brought all of the Russian, the Nazi spies after World War II to Huntsville, Alabama and Redstone Arsenal to develop the initial rocket programs and ultimately NASA, that's not a conspiracy theory. That's easily validated history for anybody that takes the time to search. After the war was completed in Europe and NATO was created, when they recognized that Russia was going to be an ongoing threat, ultimately the leadership of NATO, if you look at them, you can find the original leaders of the Europe, of the European Union and NATO in their Nazi uniforms that once they surrendered, they were put back into roles of leadership in the same fashion that if we would not have had a 20-year war in Iraq if we had worked with the local government and rehabilitated the leaders that were in a position to keep some stability, right, wrong, or indifferent, that's been our modus operandi as a U.S. government for time immemorial. In Japan, we did the same thing. So the point is that, and it's not, this is not, none of this is a conspiracy theory. I love
but what makes
history,
them so special?
And I do a
you said Nazi uniforms, we took them and put them in. Why put those people in power? What makes them so special? Who are they? Why? Well, they got some special bloodline or connections, or they know people. I mean, you know, why them? You know, why are they? Why? Because all their wealth was taken. So why them? Because of their name or who they know?
Well, I think that. So, do I believe the Rothschilds are a power broker family because they have an unbelievable amount of wealth, trillions and trillions of dollars? Absolutely, I do. Most people are not aware that the primary owners, the largest shareholders of all three, BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard, are the Rothschilds. Are they involved in driving the agenda that's coming through the World Economic Forum? Absolutely they are. But I think that the reason that the U.S. government chose to utilize the leaders of the country that they had is because they were successful at leading the Nazi German government. And that they were people who already had connections, and they knew how bureaucracies worked, and they knew how to make a government function. And for the ones that were willing to swear an oath to the new structure and to join NATO and become part of that, did most of the war criminals get charged and dealt with in The Hague? I think that many of them did.
Not most. Well,
but
a lot of
many
did, but
of
most them
of didn't.
Didn't.
Right. Yeah. That's the whole point. Because the ones that could add to the U.S.'s development of their scientific and space research came here. The ones that had the opportunity to rebuild Europe, it wasn't necessarily because of some bloodline or some special function. It had more to do with, and there are lots of theories about, I mean, we have it here in the United States. Anybody that does any research at all, most of our founding fathers were Masons, and the Masonic orders have always been a partnership of members helping members to continue to grow in their careers and build power. And I'm not saying all members of the Masons are bad people, but when you get to the highest echelons, the things that you're required to do and the oaths that you're required to take separate you from the country is no longer your primary concern. God has to be turned away because they have their own God that they worship. So you can get down a whole deep rabbit hole, but ultimately I think that the primary reason that they're utilized is because they have the right sorts of connections and the right sort of financial capability, and it's usually the wealthiest of them. A lot of the leaders in Nazi Germany were former royal family members who were previously in the German military. Many of them hated the Nazis, but they kept their mouth shut, and they marched to the beat of the drum, just like there's a lot of really good people in the Customs and Border Patrol down at the border right now that are still following orders and allowing an invasion to happen in our country. So
yep.
I think that are there super wealthy families with names that have an investment in not losing their money and keeping a power structure? Absolutely. But I think that the majority of the people that drive this sort of an agenda are not the uber wealthy. They're the people that desperately want to be in the club. It's why people pay $90,000 a year to go to an Ivy League school, and then at Yale, the Skull and Bones Club. It's a real thing. And the people that join it, they help each other become successful and wealthy, whether they go into Wall Street or they go into politics. It's a real thing. And most of the upper echelons of our country have the Bilderberg Foundation is a real thing. And what happens is people in wealthy families have always been a part of it, and they continue to go to those same schools, and they become the next leader generation in our country, the example, the royal families, the Kennedys of our world. That Joseph Kennedy was a prohibition rum runner mobster, but once he got enough wealth to buy his way into the club, he then became the club. Robert F. Kennedy benefits from the wealth of a family that started in very deep and dark holes, but once they got into the right schools and members of the right clubs, they became the puppets that could lead the government. And when they didn't stand in line, the three-letter agencies that really ultimately are the ones who drive, I think, the direction. And so to answer your question, I know it's a long, wide story. Are the big names that we all know about, if we do a little research, are they real? Yes. Do they influence things? Absolutely. Are the uber wealthy going to the same schools and becoming same part of the same clubs and leading? That's another leg of the stool. But the leg of the stool that is probably the most scary for us as citizens are the government employees who figure out how to play the system and capitulate with the programs and to become tools. And they ultimately are the ones who are driving the agenda that we see right now, be it ESG or DEI or the other programs that are being used to influence our programs, the socialist takeover of our public school system. The reality is that I don't think that what's happening now is a new thing. George Bush Sr. was the head of the CIA. He knew all of the secrets, and he became president. And he was the one who instituted the New World Order as a dialogue. That was a conversation that he gave in speeches. And since him, every president, with the exception of the person that came out of left field because the people actually wanted him, with President Trump as the candidate, and then president. They messed up all the plans. It was supposed to be Hillary Clinton. And he went in there as a well-intentioned businessman with a tremendous amount of knowledge about how to get things done without recognizing just how deep the swamp really is. And he trusted too much. And I think that if he wins this election, which I know they're going to do everything in their power to keep from him, as we are seeing with the injustice system and the weaponization of our legal system. And, we're supposed to have an executive branch that runs the administrations. We're supposed to have the People's House with the Congress that hold the purse strings and the Senate as their counterbalance and ultimately the Supreme Court as the judicial branch. When we have the justice system and the judicial branch working hand in hand, and based on the latest votes that we're seeing and the funding for the overseas expenditures in all of this money that we're pouring down the drain, you were talking about the latest bill, $90 billion. $60 billion of that is earmarked for Ukraine. You know, only $20 billion of it is actually going to Ukraine. $40 billion of it is being spent with defense contractors and reconstruction efforts here in the United States. So it's a prop up to push money back into the U.S. economy so that it can then be funneled through and laundered through Ukraine.
Wow. So will we see any of it here in the United States, though? Will the infrastructure in the United States benefit from that with these defense contractors, or does that go to all foreign countries and we don't see any of it? Like,
won't
create jobs, not going to build anything?
I think it won't build anything. It'll create jobs in the defense industries, the large defense organizations. It's funny to me. You know, I've been working, and I won't use the names of the company, but I'll work with, let's say, ABC Defense Contractor. An ABC Defense Contractor's had a contract with the U.S. military, and they have a big warehouse. Well, their bid comes up, and it's time for them to lose the contract and for somebody else to get the contract, because it's a rotation. It's not because one is getting it or the other. They all work together.
Mm-hmm.
They take the sign down on the outside of the building. The new defense contractor takes over the contract. They hire all of the employees that were just about to be laid off. The same people work in the same building doing the same thing, but now it's got a new defense contractor's name on the outside. And the bag of washers that was $75,000 is now $80,000, and it just has a different company's name on it. And every time the contract cycle, it does the same thing. So literally, you can go and buy a bag of washers off of the shelf at Lowe's or Home Depot for $100 or less, and that same thing is being sold for $80,000 to the U.S. government. The proverbial $600 hammers is a real thing.
Yeah, that's one of my problems.
So does it help the economy?
It
helps the economy with a very small group of people that are in working-class jobs or professional-level middle-class jobs. But the profits go to the organization, and they spend an absolute fortune on lobbying efforts and donations to campaigns and to PACs to keep things going so that they can keep funneling the money through. So the top 1 or 2% of those corporations are the ones making the greatest benefit from it. But the people in the top 20% of the jobs are the retired military generals who are now going back to their buddies and selling these deals. I mean, could you imagine if we as a citizen said, okay, I'm going to buy this new Ford truck, and no matter what Ford charges me, I am only going to buy my parts and materials from Ford, and they know I'm only going to buy them from Ford. What's Ford going to do? They're going to take advantage of my stupidity. And the way the business is run is so different than the government environment. It's funny. I was in the Middle East. I mentioned, and I was at a conference for a contract that had multiple carriers. So lots of aviation companies and freight forwarders and transportation carriers were at this conference. And the U.S. military put up a slide that showed us a graph of the lowest cost player and the highest cost player. They didn't tell us who it was that was the lowest cost or the highest cost. But they showed it, and they said, well, we need everybody to be over here in the average. Every single company in that room wrote down the top-end number, and that was the new mean. You know what I mean? And that's the mentality of government, is that the people that grow up in the government never have to learn how to budget, because the budget is you spend everything that you got this year or you won't get it next year. There is no profitability measure. There is no cost-cutting benefit. There's literally no incentive to reduce the spending, because even if you're just a salaried person making $100,000 or $150,000 a year, that's a pretty decent living. Well, it was until the Biden economy
drove it down. I got some people there. Hang on one second here, Ethan. I'll bring a couple people on, but I don't want to turn it into a debate. You know, or if you want to jump into conversation, that's fine. But then we're not here to argue or preach to anybody here tonight. So, because we don't want more shouting contests. So 657-383-0616. I got one person with their hand up. I'll bring them on. All right.
Mm-hmm.
All right. 225. Go ahead. Here we go. 225. You're unmuted. Okay.
Is that when he saw that the Francis Scott Key Bridge, what happened with that bridge, which is a big logistics thing, and it helps us. What was his thoughts about what happened with that bridge?
I've It's a good point, and I do live my life. So just to be clear, my business is 100% air freight. But the supply chain is the supply chain, and all of it impacts. So even though I don't work in the ocean business, if the ocean business has failures, then the air business has a drastic increase in volume because of the blockage of a port. So I watch it very closely, and there's a few things that I'll say. The first thing is the level of safety measures built into those ships is unbelievable. There are two complete control systems that are completely separated on those ocean container ships. And to switch from one complete steerage system and engine system to a completely separate control system and steering system, completely independent, if one gets hacked, the other is still separate, takes less than 30 seconds. Additionally, if you watch the videos from all of the different angles, there's literally no way that the ship, based on the currents, my dad is an avid sailor, and I've got a photo of myself at 6 weeks old on their sailboat when I was a little boy. It's my grandfather's sailboat. And my father loves to sail. He never had the money for it, but all that to say that if you know anything about the way that tides work and anything the way that water works, the ship should have pulled away from the bridge. And they're literally built with that in mind. Where they put the piers and where they put the legs on bridges is built with the concept of a moving tide. And in a bay like that, the rise and fall of the tide is significant. So it has to be taken into consideration when they're doing the engineering for it. There is no question in my mind that there is an intentional element. Now, I don't know what caused it. I don't know whether it was the fact that the captain was Ukrainian and maybe he was paid to do it. The crew was Indian and were just laborers from a third country national environment. I did look up the ownership of the ship, and it is a no-name, faceless office that actually owns the ship in Singapore. And I've been to Singapore many times in my work world, and this is a little teeny hole-in-the-wall placeholder for a company that owns a handful of ships, and they work through a large brokerage system that contracts out that ship, and that contracting company manages over 600 ships. And that happened, that ship was contracted to one of the largest, Maersk, one of the largest shipping companies in the world, but it's not their ship. They don't own it. They just contracted under a long-term contract. So to the basic question at the very beginning, was it intentional? I absolutely think it was. I don't know whether it was that it got hacked by a foreign government. I don't know if it was something that was planted by us. I do think it's amazingly interesting that the agent in charge of the Baltimore FBI office was replaced with someone else the night before the accident happened. I think it's absolutely mind-boggling that the president came out and said that insurance isn't going to pay for this, which should be the go-to in a circumstance like this. In any environment, it's the commercial organization and their insurance companies that should be liable for something like this, but the president came out and said that the taxpayers are going to pay for it before an investigation was done. They closed the initial investigation by noon the second day. They've now reopened a case, but it's with the same person that was put into that office in that position and promoted to do what he was told the night before. So is it shady as can be? Yes.
Then you just got your answer. All those things involved, all the connections right there of everything that happened, just like you said, the night before this, night before this, and this happened, and the current, and common sense. You know, I mean, it's not, we don't have idiots out there that are running these types of things. These people are very smart, and there's a lot of money involved. So it's all well coordinated and well planned, everything. And that's one thing I wanted to ask you, too, is remember you kept mentioning agenda that these people have. What is the agenda, then, you think, in your opinion? I know you don't know what it is, but because you don't talk to the devil or Satan, and you're not one of these, because you wouldn't be talking to me. But if there was, you know, what is their agenda, you think, in the end?
Well, if you look at every socialist society in history, whether it's Russia or China or what's happened in Venezuela, by crashing the economy and putting people out of work, they become dependent on the government. And our constitutional republic has been called a democracy for the last 20 years in our educational system. Civics isn't taught. People aren't educated on the Bill of Rights or the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution. I was super blessed to have parents that believe strongly in what makes a constitutional republic so important about individual liberty versus mob rule, which is a democracy. And for 20 years, the media and our government has been using that terminology. And even the people that are the most conservative in our government, you watch Marjorie Taylor Greene or any of the other very strong-willed people that show to be fighting, they still call it a democracy on the news rather than a constitutional republic. And the left is very clear. We know that the further left you go in the Democratic Party, that they are, by definition, hardline Marxist socialists. They are.
I hate America. Yeah. I got 314 on here. I got 314 on here. Go ahead, Bianchi. I think that's him.
No, that was an accident. It wasn't nobody doing anything. You know, all the containers, when we order containers, you have to have insurance on the containers from they leave the warehouse until they reach their destination, wherever they get destined to go. And believe it or not, all those containers have the ability to be tracked wherever they are if they, you know, modern. People said it was explosion. Well, where is the powder barns on the structure still? And those bridges just sit there on those piers. I see a lot of bridges in my life. They're not tied down because they got allowed for sliding on Teflon pads for expansion and contraction. But then again, knowing the Democrats, who knows?
Well, going back to that original question, it's a good point. Every single ocean container in the world has an RFID tag system, and they can be tracked. But did you know that we, coming through our ports, less than 10%, and that's a high number, less than 10% are actually inspected? So when you talk about the ability to smuggle goods in and out of the country through ocean container movements or gray ships, ships like this that are owned by a super small company that doesn't have any, you know, tie-in to anywhere else, and it's flagged in Singapore to avoid the tax structure, the amount of smuggling and impact to our economy that comes through the ports is absolutely mind-boggling, even though they have the conceptual ability to track. The big shipping companies put those RFID tags on, and they charge the insurance to their customers, but most of the shipping companies, that's a profit center for them because the vast majority of the containers make it where they're going, and it's just a way to make an additional profit margin. Now, if something happens, they will compensate the customers. But when it comes to this port in particular, two of our fastest battleships are now locked in their base at their docks. They cannot get out of the port. The United States has two aircraft carrier fleets in the Gulf standing guard for Israel, but Russia has an aircraft carrier fleet in the Gulf as well. That's not on our news. The fact that those two battleships are blocked in is a major weakening of our ability to recover or to defend the East Coast of the United States. From an economic perspective, what is it, $60 billion, between $60 and $80 billion a year worth of trade comes through that port. It's also the single largest port of entry in the United States for tractors, equipment, like construction equipment, tractor wheeled, and automotive that are imported to the United States. What's that going to do to the cost of cars? It's going to drive them up like crazy, like we saw during COVID. Right now, cars are astronomically expensive if you want to go buy a new car. It's going to be a point where people are not going to be able to afford cars. What does that do? It pushes people towards environments where they don't have to have a car. 15-minute cities is on the agenda from World Economic Forum all the way down to our local governments. Removing mobility and the ability to transit is not a small step. So what is the strategy? I'm not bright enough to have a total picture of it, but I can tell you, based on supply chain and logistics and the way that things move, you take that much of a chunk out of the economy and your availability to bring goods in. all of the hundreds and hundreds of fires in the food production system over the last 2 years, planes crashing into production facilities, the single largest chicken farm in the country generating something like 120 million chickens a year into the food system, just burnt to the ground in Texas. By reducing your availability of food in the United States, by reducing the availability of vehicles in the United States, you create intentional hardship. Intentional hardship makes people panicky. Panicky people will say yes to whatever it is that's going to make their life easier. In the same fashion that after 9/11, everybody was for the Patriot Act because we were willing to put our knee on the ground and bend the knee to get a little bit of safety. As Benjamin Franklin said, if you're willing to give up your liberty for a little bit of safety, you don't deserve it. That's paraphrasing. But the point only is that the agenda is the more that people have to depend on the government, crime in the cities. Why would they be allowing all of the criminals to be walking back out after bail? Because if the crime gets bad enough, the people will beg the government to take their rights away to give them more safety. I think that all of these things are intentional.
I don't think the people in the city is going to ever complain. And you know, one other thing I'm going to tell you about those containers, wherever the port that they loaded, they passed through x-rays. And the x-ray of those containers, there have been many times when people try to smuggle humans in those containers, and they do pick them up. And they also have the ability in those detectors to detect any nuclear material going either way out or coming in. So, you know, you're right. There's a lot of myths going on.
If you pull up the Customs and Border Patrol statistics for the number of ship containers that are actually x-rayed or inspected, it's 10% of them. That's how many actually go through the x-ray.
Yeah, that might be the United States. You know, I designed a shipping port for Ondo State there in Nigeria, which would make it the largest in the world. And the authorities there agreed upon it. But it's got all modern stuff in it. And they do have x-ray where you can x-ray those containers. And they, like I say, there have been cases where they had people hiding inside trying to get wherever they're trying to go, and they are detected.
That is true. I think 267, I'm going to bring up 267 to you. Area code 267. I think that's, we got four people on here. Go ahead, there, 267.
So why does anybody stay in the United States? You have no rule of law. You have people who are running amok. You're seeing the results of children, of other children who have no emotional values. They'll stomp somebody's head into the ground. Why stay there? And I'm just looking at it from a larger scale. So you're in California. Did you abandon California if you moved to Texas? Did you abandon the United States if you moved abroad, where you're treated much better?
I think that there's a couple answers, and this is just my opinion. But having lived in – I've been to 91 countries in my travels, and I've lived in multiple places overseas for anywhere from 90 days to 2 years, both from military service all the way through to my commercial job. What's happening in the United States is happening in all of the Western countries. So the United Kingdom,
well,
it's happening all across the United States. It's happening.
Countries.
No. I was only
saying
going to say
just
that,
the Western countries.
Yeah, no. I understand what you're saying. For example, if you want to move to the Philippines or Thailand or even Vietnam, which is a communist country, your dollar stretches exponentially further, and you can live like the top 2% in that country on a Social Security retirement from the United States. That there are places all around the world that you can't. But you give up a lot when you go to developing nations. And the thing is that in every country in the world,
let's set the frame of
sure,
this.
Go ahead.
I live in Thailand. I've been here almost 9 years. Is Thailand a developing nation or a third world nation?
It's still considered a developing nation, but they're making headway because of the impact on manufacture and supply from COVID it's had a huge upsurge in manufacturing and contracts. I see this in just in the trade lanes where the materials are moving from. Lots of companies are very gun shy about China, and so places like Thailand are seeing a huge upsurge in large organizations shifting their manufacturing there because the cost of goods are still much lower. I would say that there are parts of Thailand where a lot of expatriates are and the wealthiest of the Thai people are, and I love Thailand. I think that it's one of the best countries in the world. The food is fantastic. The people in general are friendly, but there's a lot of Thailand that's still very, very poor. And when you get outside of the city and you start going into the countryside at all, there are people that are still living in the
1700s. You can go to Alabama or Appalachia and show me poor people. So,
well,
the
argument
Thailand,
back to that.
I have to agree on that because
ahead.
I can stay in Ghana, West Africa for $1,000 a month. I could have a maid, a chauffeur, and a gardener as long as I own my car and have my house. But, you know, the key thing that makes the difference is the people. You know, you can go to places where the people, yes, sir, no, sir, good morning, so on, so on, compared to here in the States, you say good morning to somebody and they pull a gun out and try to rob you. It's the difference in the people, and you got a strange people here in the United States, man.
I think that
getting strange
a lot
by
of that,
the moment.
The last 20 years have been the driving shift in our population, and I think that, honestly, you know, I just from our voices, I think the majority of us on the phone remember the screeching sound of our first dial-up. The internet has changed the world for a lot of negative. It's made business move faster. It's made connectivity easier. It's made it possible for us to have a conversation with somebody in Thailand on this call. But when you look at the U.S. population today, when I worked in Bahrain, there were 500 employees.
Well, wait,
what's
your point about the U.S. population?
I'm going to get to it. I'm going to get to it. In that location in Bahrain, 500 employees, about 250 of them were local. All the rest were expatriates. Out of the 250 expatriates, there were two Americans. There were South Africans. There were Brits. There were Aussies. There were New Zealanders. There were folks from all over the world. People came from India and Pakistan and Bangladesh who came there to work. And they actually had two different pay scales, depending on what color your passport was and which country you came from. In the United States population, Department of State statistics show that less than 4% of the population has an active passport. Less than 2% of the population has used it. So 340 million people, that puts us at 3.4 million for 1%, 6.8%, 6.8 million people in the United States are the small group of human beings like those, there are three of us on the phone here, that have done our travel around the world. There's a huge percentage of our population who has never traveled outside of the United States and only knows about it what they see on the news.
That's their
if
problem.
They bother to watch the
That's
news
their
at all.
That's problem, isn't it?
It is
Why
their
are you
problem.
Worried about it?
It is. But that answers the question back. Why do I not leave?
About what? I've forgotten what the question is.
Your original question
you've
was, why don't
and,
people
look,
leave?
Look, you've gone on and on and giving an answer that when I asked you for to get to the point, you wanted to go further and further out there. So who cares about the people that are in the U.S. that don't care, that don't know, that think that the border ends at the Jersey Shore? They're not my problem. In fact, they're part of the problem because they allowed society to become what it is today. And they did that through their vote and through other ways. So
Let me ask you this question, sir. So, therefore, if the founders took that attitude, because there's only 3% that actually fought in the revolution, and the rest took side with the king, we wouldn't have a country today if we had that type of if we continued with that type of mentality. We have
you
to
might
stand
be right,
with evil forces when
that...
good men do nothing.
Well, yeah, okay, you might be right, but let's talk about what it is that you can do. Okay, now let's just say that Trump gets in. Somehow they don't kill him, they don't throw him in jail, they don't find some obscure law from the Scottish Rites, whatever it is, thank you, our inspector, they don't find some weird law, whatever, to come up and get rid of him, and he becomes president. What happens the day after he leaves? So you have a a population now, I don't even know what you call them, the ones that are 18, 19, in their 20s. They don't know anything about the Constitution. In fact, they probably don't even know that there's 51 constitutions. Everybody thinks there's just one. And what are they going to do? They don't care. They embrace socialism. So the day after Trump leaves, what happens to America? It falls into rapid deterioration again, maybe worse than what we're seeing now.
I would argue that that's a generalization, and any generalization is going to have the flaw of pure general stereotype. I know a lot of 18- and 19-year-old kids that do not feel that way, who do work, that do have a desire to make the country a better place. The reason that
you're
I started the conversation off originally.
You're talking about the like generation, right? The like generation. Like, you know, like this, like that. It's become so pervasive. I heard Tucker Carlson using the word like at least once or twice in a sentence. Every sentence.
Now,
he was the one being interviewed.
Let me ask him then. Well, so what do we do then? So we just throw our hands up in the air? What do we do? What could be the answer then?
I will tell you what I did. I've been in the liberty fight since the early 90s. And there's less people to talk to. The theory of I forget who the group was, and I was a part of them for a while. The ones that say, you know, do it one at a time. There's no time for that. You have an onslaught of people who embrace socialism. Isn't that enough? They embrace socialism. Now, how are you ever with those people in charge, and they will be in charge, so how are you ever going to advance liberty? You're not. You're going to go backwards. They're going to take the – apparently, like a drunk – the United States of America must be brought not to its knees, but laying on the ground prostrate before the people are going to lift it up. Several constitutions, especially the original constitutions of the 13 colonies, enumerate that the people can, under threat of taking up arms, abolish their government as they see fit. And yet, if you talk about it, they'll tell you, well, that's treason, or you're committing a crime. And I'll tell you right now, from my observation, the time for the people to invoke those rights came and went. And now nobody cares. Just like 9/11. Nobody cares about 9/11. Nobody cares about the Mara Federal Building, which was really the pretext to all this law that has put not only its thumb, but its handprint all over the top of everybody. Take money out of your bank, and they ask you why. Why are you taking that money out of the bank? And by the way, I'm just remembering your infographic from the show on BTR. You didn't put a United States note in there, which should be talked about. Not a Federal Reserve note, the United States note. But Back to this whole thing. You have an onslaught of people who embrace socialism. How do you get around that? Well, you the one person, you're gonna fight and stop it. You can't stop it any more than you can put your hand out in front of a freight train rolling at 1 mile an hour. You're not gonna stop it.
So we said,
so go
with
your appreciation.
Hang on, your answer. Go ahead, Ethan.
All I was going to say is I'm not willing to surrender. That I understand the reason to leave, but my mom and dad are too old for it. My grandmother's still around. My brothers and sisters don't have the financial capability to up and pull out. My home is here, and I'm willing to fight and die for it. And if right now we can fight via something
May
as
I
simple
ask you
as
a question?
Getting –
What would you
let
be
me
dying
just say
for?
The one thing.
Now, what would you be well, – what would you be dying for? Can you tell me?
For the belief in what the country should be.
Who believes it, you or anybody else? The majority of the people 3%. Disagree with you.
The majority of the people disagreed with the founding fathers. If 3% of the people stood up today, we could take our country back. My starting point is as simple as changing
why
who it is that's
so
in charge
already?
Of local elections.
Why
it's not painful
we done
enough.
So already?
It's not. It's because our life
well,
is
well,
that's
too exactly
easy.
What I said. The United States has to lay on the ground prostrate, not get on its knees, but get worse than that, in the gutter, before anybody's going to bring it up.
It boils down to what Dan Bongino said. It hasn't gotten bad enough yet for people to stand up, to change how they think about things. You know, it hasn't
gotten bad enough for some people. It's gotten bad enough for
some
people,
but not the majority of people. I mean...
Well, hang on. You're forgetting one thing here. There's a divine purpose here, too. You know, I don't know what you guys believe in. I don't know. But I'll tell you what, there is a God. There is a creator. And there is a plan. And look, if this is what God's plan is going to be, fine. But he also says that you can have an awakening, and then he'll heal your land. So that's for, you know, like I said, again, the original quote, when good men do nothing, evil flourishes. It doesn't mean I'm going to allow evil to trample all over me. You know, I'm going to pray for my enemies.
But
you know, I'm going to pray
for
the sick and the weak.
I don't think you realize that all of this has been done against you was 100 years ago. You're now seeing the fruits of it. You're seeing the what's coming off the tree. This has been done to you before you were even born.
You know,
exactly.
I've mentioned this book before on other shows that we've been on, but there's this book that Woodrow Wilson was one of his favorite books called Philip Drew Administrator, talking about how the government is not run by the president or the vice president or the house, and it's run by all these government workers, these administrators, right? So this is where we're standing,
and that's paper cuts.
That's right. Here's the thing that they fear the most, is that Trump will come in there, get elected. Let's just say, for instance, he does. All these court cases go away, or the ones that can be put off are going to be put off.
How quickly did they undo Trump when he got in? How quickly did they undo him? How long did it take?
Right.
Not long.
They undo him, but here's the deal. He also had a problem.
No matter what Trump does,
Ben Bongino said is personnel is policy, and a lot of the people who were there when he first got in there, he kept a lot of the people that were these guys that were the lifelong people that
Who's allowing? Who does the allowing, if you don't mind?
I think Trump's lack of experience. I think Trump's lack of experience the last time he went in led him to trust too much.
And
I think that this time
he did,
but he had that 4 years. He's also had 4 years of persecution on the outside. And I think that the difference
now,
in who he's going to bring into his table is going to make a big difference.
Wouldn't that make you angry? Does he look like some guy that rolls over and takes it, or do you think he's somebody that gets angry and does something about it?
I think he's pretty friggin' angry.
He's pissed. Yes, and he ought to be. Let me ask you a question. I hear this all the time on the YouTube videos that I watch. A lot of people, they say this. Who thinks that you have the right to bear arms from the Second Amendment? Anybody?
What do you mean, who thinks they have a right? I believe I have a right, not just from the Second Amendment, from my creator, God. No man can tell me what to do.
Okay. Well, okay. But does the Second Amendment give you the right to bear arms federally?
Well, according to the government, they should, or that's what the Constitution outlines, if that's the way you want to reinterpret the Constitution. But case law is also affirming that.
No,
that's
not the way the Constitution. It's not the way the Constitution words it.
To answer that question,
men had the right to bear arms and protect themselves way before a Second Amendment. And I hear what
yeah,
you're
that's
saying.
What I mean, yeah.
I think that you're going to have – if we don't have free and transparent
ballots.
Well,
Let me finish, please.
If we don't have free and transparent ballots, at the same time, you got another issue that's going on by some organization for Article 5 amendment of the Constitution. If those don't work, then I think states are going to draw their lines, and people are going to say we are not going to do it. Now,
all right, I got
you,
a great question.
When people,
let me ask my question.
We're not going to do it. Then what?
There's going to be. Everybody says it's going to be a civil war. Yes. How would that look?
No, I don't think I. Well, how would that work? Well, you said you've been in the patriot community since what? The early '90s. You said you've been a part of the liberty movement. Well, that's how long I've been. Okay, and I remember the Weaver incident. That you know, and I remember we were all going to do something back then. I remember the Waco. Everybody's going to do something back then. Oklahoma City. You know, I remember the militias in the '90s. Okay, I remember all that.
Nothing's been done.
But
liberty has been.
I can assure you. Hang on. I can assure you.
Ever since.
But I can assure you. I can assure you. They have not picked on the wrong guy yet. You remember the Bundy Ranch, right? Look what happened to the Bundy Ranch. They backed down pretty quick there, didn't they? Okay. So there are certain elements of our society that if they do make the mistake, the three-letter organizations or whatever, the alphabet soup or whatever they want to do, they pick the wrong group out, yes, that could spark a movement or a civil war.
Let me
ask
you a question related to what you're talking about. So which of these three-letter groups defend liberty? Any of them?
None of them. They're all unconstitutional.
So the United States in the form that it's in now, as I don't even know where I'm standing on when I'm standing there, which jurisdiction. It's been so raveled around. But the United States is a pirate ship that is trampling. Running over, I wouldn't even care about if they damaged manatees. They're running over everybody with this pirate ship. And who gave them the ship? They're just the inhabitants of the ship. Who gave them the ship in the first place? And who are they?
Well, we can say the same thing about the Roman Empire. We can say, you know, we can say
small
powers. About one. Yeah, you know, it's history. This is history. You know, this is the cycle of history.
Every agency's against you. You, the people.
You know, regardless of the arguments about where Vivek Ramaswamy came from and his link to Soros from funding and all the other variables, the policy that he puts forward and the president's power to cut the federal government by 70% or 80%, the president has that legal right. Mass layoffs absolutely are a reality. That's the only way that it's going to happen without a civil war.
Yeah.
If Trump goes in and does that, then
yeah,
we have
but
a chance.
People say civil war. You can't describe what that would look like.
Nobody could.
No. Who's on one side and who's on the other side? Tell me.
It would not be that way. You'd have tribalist people.
Everybody's telling me the way it won't be. Tell me what it would look like.
It looked like Afghanistan.
Yeah,
well,
because it's like Afghanistan.
The
there you go. That's a good example.
We're going to end up being
a civil war. Would look like?
We would be Boston.
What do you think a civil war would look like?
We would be Boston. That's a good question.
You don't have a Mason-Dixon line. You've got one house next to another house. So is it going to be like watching Microsoft's game where they all walk in mass and
haven't answered the question. If all those things have been played, what would it look like?
What do you think?
Nobody's
in your
answering that. Well, it's logistically impossible.
Well, what is a civil war should look like?
Well, I think it should look like what you saw, one side against the other. You pretty much knew which side you were on.
Didn't go by neighborhood.
Right. Well, we basically have that right now, don't we?
Gangs in the street.
83 million
gangs
people
in the street.
Yeah. You've got 80 million people on one side and 80 million on the other.
Yeah.
That actually
bothered
the
vote. Yeah,
that's
what you got between Republican, Republican and Democrat. It's socialist, like you described. It's socialist.
Listen, it's not that easy. Everybody talks about this panacea. I would die for your rights. Well, guess what? I'm not dying for anybody's rights. Die for my rights.
You got millions of people that have served in the military that would disagree with you.
Yes.
That would die for
yes.
the flag, die for this country,
well,
even
okay,
today.
But let me
you
ask
know?
You this. But let's pick the latest conflict, which was Vietnam. Now, I have asked a lot of military vets this very same question. What were we doing in Vietnam? What was the ultimate goal? Do you know?
We don't
nope.
know. I got a private. Hang on, we bring on this private caller. This might be Sarge. The private caller, go ahead.
Yeah, guys, I'm fascinated by this conversation.
Oh,
I decided I was just going to listen.
Sarge.
But you know, I got to admit
Sarge.
That you know, I gotta come in and weigh in on it now that I've heard the things I've heard. I just plan to listen, but I got to say a couple of things.
What have you heard, Sarge? And tell us what you've heard.
I've heard innumerable things that that make me say to myself, everybody's got a piece of the pie, but nobody's got the entire pie. Some people have more of the pie than others, but a rather grasp of the big picture. And some people are completely missing the boat altogether. Let me give you an example of what I believe it was you who made the statement about, well, what happens after Trump gets elected and he's out of office, as though that's the end of history.
Yeah.
I mean, Donald Trump is elected. He doesn't achieve all of his objectives, so therefore all is nigh, all is doomed. No, that's not the way you're supposed to look at it.
Bureaucrats?
Yeah, let me explain to you. Let me explain something. Hold on now. Let me finish. All right, look. First of all, that is why it is key that Donald Trump doesn't pick a Kamala Harris vice president. A goofy nincompoop who's just done there to check a couple of boxes. He's got to pick someone who is capable, competent, and able to carry through his agenda. But remember, that is not the main point here. We have a federalist system of government in aspiration and in reality. It's federalist. It's not one big concentrated government. Not federal, not state, not local. It's all of it. And the solutions to the problems we're in are going to be federalist solutions. We're going to have to worry about the federal government. We got to worry about state governments. We got to worry about the local government. So Donald Trump isn't the whole answer anyway. He never was intended to be. What he can't. Wait a minute. One more thing, and then I'll let you. Then I'll, one more sentence. Let me finish. What Donald Trump can be is a bulwark, a boulder in the stream to cut down and stem this god-awful, hard tachistocracy that governs us. I'll be happy just to see the tide stop for a moment so he can dam the thing up. And if Donald Trump does that, great. I think he can do that. And then we can start working on how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. And that's where we got to go looking at this. At all levels, a federalist solution to this problem.
You've been eaten, Sarge. You've already been eaten, Sarge.
No, I haven't. No, I haven't. Not no. No, no. People tell me I have,
absolutely,
and I refuse to believe it.
Me too.
Anyway, Ethan, hang on. I don't want to take away from my guest here. Hang on. I don't want to take away from my guest here. The conversation I'm having with Ethan here, and Sarge, you're a Vietnam veteran. You're a retired state trooper, actually. So you would know the streets and know what's going on, and you're very well versed in history. I mean, even though this caller here may not agree with you.
So ask Sarge the question. Ask
him what?
What were we doing in Vietnam? Why were we in Vietnam, and what was the goal?
Okay, go ahead, Sarge.
The professed objective, I'm going to give you that first, then I'll tell you what I think actually happened. The professed objective was to prevent an invasion by North Vietnam. Actually, it was disguised as a local insurgency. To some extent it was, maybe 50, 60% of it was. 40% of it when it began was managed from North Vietnam. Later on, after the Tet Offensive, when the Viet Cong got practically wiped out, the North Vietnamese took it over almost completely. But the objective was to stop the South Vietnamese government from collapsing and falling to a North Vietnam, not Vietnamese invasion, which ultimately it did fall to, not a guerrilla campaign, but a conventional invasion led by an armored corps. That's what happened.
Who was defending South Vietnam at the time? Us?
No. Actually, the South Vietnamese were carrying the burden of the fight until about 1965. It was the South Vietnamese that was carrying the burden. In fact, for much of the war, whether we want to admit it or not, they did take most of the fight, despite the corruption in the South Vietnamese government. The South Vietnamese did most of the fighting and took most of the casualties.
Okay, I get it.
Now I'll tell you. Now, if you want to know what could have happened, all you got to do is read General Giap's memoirs or his chief of staff, Colonel Bui Tin, and that will tell you what should have been done if they wanted to turn back the North Vietnamese and defeat them and win the war.
Guys, we're not going to debate the Vietnam War here tonight. That's not what this is about. Well, hang on. Sir, you have a defeatist attitude toward. You said you've been in the Patriot community since the early 90s. With what you claim that you say you have been involved with since the early 90s, I just don't hear it from you. I just don't hear it. I really don't.
You don't hear it? What is it that you could ask me that might tell you?
I don't know. Only you can actually give me that answer. Only you can.
Well, no. You just said you don't hear it. What is it that you need to hear?
Well, I can tell you what I hear.
Go ahead, yeah. Go ahead there, brother.
I hear that you said you're not willing to die for anybody else, that you're not willing to die for the country that we do have left, that you've left and moved to Thailand and you're no longer a part of the argument. My real question would be,
sure.
Why are you invested
I continue to vote. I have a voice. I'm here on Blog Talk Radio just as you are.
Yeah, but you made the statement you're not willing to die for anybody in America. You're not willing to fight. So what will you fight for? If the war came to your doorstep, what would you do?
How is that in my favor to die for you? Explain that.
Well, it may not be, but I thought the saying was he who won't die for anything will not live for anything either. You'd die for your family, wouldn't you? You'd die for your children, wouldn't you? Or would you?
Look at all the people who died in Vietnam.
Would you die for anyone? Would you die for your relatives, for your wife, for your children? So I hope you would die for something if you had to.
It's very simple, sir. It's very simple. John Adams stated, always stand on principle even if you stand alone, okay? Many quotes over the years. It is better to offer no excuse than a bad one. George Washington. You want me to go Franklin now?
Hold on. Don't we call that tilting at windmills?
Learn to think continuity. Do you want to know who you are? Don't ask. Act. Action will jump.
Hey, tell me something.
Look,
Joe, do you know any group of people in history who were exceeded by the people who framed the American Revolution? Talk about tilting at a windmill. They went against the greatest military power on the planet at the time it all started. And by the way, which leads me to another thing I heard earlier about Ruby Ridge and Waco. Okay, even the Boston Massacre or the Boston Tea Party did not precipitate the revolution. Yeah, they could say they were somewhat precipitous of it or helped to precipitate it, but not really. Here's what precipitated the American Revolution. When the British regulars were told by Governor Gage to go to Lexington and Concord and seize the powder, shot, and munitions of the colonists in Massachusetts, they went up against the colonial government, and the colonial militia turned out to turn them back. That's what got it started. That's what the people said. That's the line we're going to draw. And even then, as Joe has pointed out, it was a small percentage of those people who actually actively participated in the revolution. But nonetheless, they were successful. So, tilting at windmills sometimes works. By the way, a lot of people thought the people who were involved in the Boston Massacre after John Adams defended them in the trial, that wasn't enough to get the American colonists really involved in it, because guess what? most of the people thought the people who attacked those British soldiers were a bunch of hooligans, and they had every right to defend themselves when John Adams successfully defended those British soldiers. So that wasn't enough. It was the attack by the British on the existing governmental structure, the colonists, the colonial government, who had a right to have a militia to defend themselves. They wanted to disarm it. And the people said, no, you've gone too far. And exercised literally in gun control. That was the catalyst for the American Revolution.
That was the, militia, by the way. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, no, what we wanted to get to, though, is locally is where the answer is. Like, coming up locally and attacking local politics. If locally in the small towns and boroughs and cities across this country, if people are not going to get together somehow or some way, even if it happens in small sections, we're not going to ever change anything. I agree. But I don't see that. I think there's enough people out there that are waking up today. That I mean, compared to 08, 2005, 2002, I think that there are a large group that are awakening. Yeah, we're losing patriots every day. They're dying of old age, yeah. But doesn't mean they can't be replaced by new ones, you know? So what do you think, Ethan?
And you know,
they're not being replaced by new ones. They're not being replaced.
Sure they are.
They
I
are.
I would beg your pardon on that. And another thing, one of the major things that Donald Trump has done is open people's eyes.
Yes, that's true. I want to get back to my guest
the
here,
combat,
Ethan, real quick. I want to give him the floor here for a few minutes. Go ahead, Ethan.
I've got a very good friend who's part of the Combat Veterans Motorcycle Club. It's a veteran organization across the United States that has over 100,000 members. Every single one of those combat vets that's part of that program is by effect an unofficial military militia member. Part of their conversations are about what's happening in the current environment. They don't train necessarily. Small groups of them have the conversations. Back to what Sarge said about the Federalist structure, I am one guy in a county where only 3,900 people bothered to vote. If I can get 1,000 people to get off of their ass, we can completely change the direction of a county. It does not necessarily take a battle at the very top. It takes it across every single component of our structure. And if my 2-year-old granddaughter has the opportunity to have an educational system that fights against the current structure because locally people give a shit enough to do the voting and to get invested. And like Joe, I'm a believer. God has a plan. And if he can use a handful of people to wake people up and to make a difference, it only takes a handful of lights in the darkness to change things. Is it a big, overwhelming, nasty battle from the top down? Yes. Have I given up? Absolutely not.
Yeah, good. And just
tell me,
you know,
one,
thing,
sir,
too,
tell me
by the way,
one
by the way, sir, I would die
tell
for you. I would die for anybody on this phone. So I just want to let you know that, okay?
And you guys want to know something that's really disturbing, and to give you an example of what we're up against. There's a black man in New York, a man named Dexter, the first person to death. I think his last name was Reed or Stanley, I forget what it is. Yeah, he got convicted in a New York court and faces 18 years in jail over his gunsmithing hobby. Meaning he was turning 80% registered receivers into completed firearms. And he was doing it at home completely legally according to the Bruin decision that the Supreme Court handed down, being tradition at the time the Second Amendment was written when local gunsmiths made unserialized firearms as a matter of due course. In fact, almost every firearm was unserialized. So anyway, he got convicted on a whole bunch of charges, And the judge in the case, some foreigner who's got a judgeship in New York, this woman told the defense attorney, and I'm quoting from what the defense attorney said when he made his opening arguments in the courtroom before the man was convicted, quote, do not bring the Second Amendment into this courtroom. It doesn't exist here. So you can't argue Second Amendment. This is New York. Now, this is what we're up against. We're up against people who literally think things that are critical and paramount in the Constitution. After all, Second Amendment is number 2 in the Bill of Rights, right behind freedom of speech. She actually decided she's going to negate it on her own and her own authority as a judge. This is something that these are the kind of things you never used to hear in courtrooms, but you hear them regularly now because of the nature of the expropriation of these cultural Marxists and what they are doing to our constitutional republic. It is everywhere. It is endemic. They are being educated this way in these Ivy-covered North Koreas called college, universities, and campuses.
Come
and
on,
this is something we got to realize what we're up against with these people.
Sarge, I think one of the things that is important for us to recognize, too, back to the whole we don't have a Mason-Dixon line anymore, we do have red states and blue states, and you can watch the exodus of the people who believe in freedom leaving California and leaving Illinois and leaving New York to move to states where there are some small bastions of freedom left. And if they can be mobilized, you do have an opportunity to make a shift. I do think that if we end up in a civil war, it will be a balkanized environment, and it'll be terrible. I'd rather do everything above board and without violence and to use the things that we do have available to us, which is why I'm focusing on the local community that I can have an impact on.
I agree. I agree completely.
And the most brutal sort of war you can possibly imagine is the Civil War. The history, the historical record is replete with the most god-awful carnage created in Civil War. They are usually the most hate-filled. They are the most brutal. They are the hardest to stamp out. And that is the last thing you want to see. But if it comes to that, it comes to that. But God have mercy. You do not want a civil war if you can avoid it.
That's the key thing right there, what you said. If it comes to that, it comes to that.
Sarge, you can't even describe what a civil war would look like. Could you?
Yes, I can very well envision what it looked like in 2024. It will not be a regional conflict like that little dust-up we had in the mid-19th century. It will be a patchwork of civil wars. That's why. It will be interspersed throughout the country. It will not look like you had a clear boundary, the Mason-Dixon line in 1860. You don't have that now. You've got blue states and red states interspersed as each other and various locales, various allegiances within the states. It would be a mess. It would be infinitely worse than what happened in 1861.
Hence,
it
would
be a furlough
after
Tennessee.
For the one angry Jew's question.
Go ahead.
It's not tactically possible.
No, it is tactically possible. It would be utter anarchy and chaos. It would be utter. It would be so difficult manage. I mean, there would be factions that would be probably coalescing and then coming apart and then coalescing with another group that had been a war with one group, and then that group faction falls apart and gets together with another one. Believe me, I am not looking to 19th century as a model. Not this time.
Well, Sarge,
it would not look like
Sarge,
that at all.
What you're going to have, like, it's going to be states drawing their lines. That's all to it. I don't want to live under. I don't want to live under the dictums of Illinois. I ain't going there.
I know. That's why this movie, Civil War, is so absurd on its face. I cannot imagine a coalition between California and Texas. That's one thing I cannot envision.
You got that right. Guys, just real quick here, because we're getting ready to wrap it up here soon, but I got my guest here, Ethan. So anything else you want to add here, Ethan, before closing thoughts here, start adding up? Because I want to play something here at the end. Or, as a matter of fact, I should play it first, really. How this is from Mark Kenorty, actually. Because he keeps asking how a civil war, you know, what it would look like. You know, what would happen if there was a civil war. You know, and I think I played this before in the past. You know, and it necessarily, I think this is how it would start. So I'm going to play it about 6 minutes long, and then we'll wrap up the show, all right?
Anyway, I want to say thank you to our friends there. Real quick, I'm going to read the prologue. This is from Battle for the Republic, Dance of Swords. So when and how would it start? Everyone knew that the conflict was at hand and that the open battle for the Republic was about to begin. The Dagger War had been raging for many, many years, with victories and defeats on both sides. Some had thought that Waco would be the boiling point, but had not gone as any had foreseen. The 90s had had its skirmishes, and the militias had performed well, but restrained themselves in the hope that some other solution would present itself. It had not. With each passing day, the pressure continued to build. The globalist agenda had been based upon lies, and the people knew it. Some were still trying to formulate a peaceful solution, but the system had its own plan, and treachery was the centerpiece of that plan. With the first blade drawn and blood spilled, there would be no turning back. In a time of its own choosing, and at a place no one had expected, the Dance of Swords would begin. That's a nice abbreviated way to explain to you when people ask me, I've had this happen, well, how do you think it's going to start? That is the, whenever I'm in private, you know, conversation with people, and y'all, a lot of you listening know this because I've spoken with you. The first concern is, how will it start? Well, let me walk you through it, because it's going to happen this way, and really we don't get to pick the location, but the goofs are going to pick somebody they want to attack. It's that simple. They're going to try, and most likely, although you never know with, like I said, we're on a sliding scale, but let's just stay between 60 and 90 days into the next year. The bat faggots combined with whatever Homeland Security bottom feeders, mostly mercenaries, are going to pick somebody that they're going to decide they want to use as an example. That action is going to be a face-off, and it's going to actually, you know, initially be casualties for those who are surprised. It's going to happen that way. They're going to get caught off guard a little bit, but not much, because everybody can sense it, feel it, taste it, touch it. And what's going to happen is people are going to call on others, and there's a lot of people who are going to mobilize. The other side's going to do the same thing. Oh, and they have all their technology, but trust me, we're pulling out all the stops, and we have all of ours. At some point, there's going to be a column of goofs in black uniforms, idiots, mostly pea brains. In fact, well, 99.9% pea brains, in their spiffy little black uniforms with all their spiffy little alphabet letters on them. And that column of Suburbans and Labs and other nonsense are going to face off at an intersection. They're going to bump into each other by accident, mostly. And it'll be a column of militia, mechanized or light mechanized, and armed up, already cock locked and ready to rock and roll. And the bottom feeders in the black uniforms will be screaming their profanities, and they'll be screaming and screaming and screaming, and the other side won't be screaming a whole lot. And somebody's going to pull a trigger. And there's going to be one hell of a popcorn exchange. It's going to, from a distance, it's going to sound like somebody opened up the popcorn pan from hell, okay? And when it's all said and done, there will be no turning back. I want you all to be ready for that. Notice I didn't shout about it. I didn't scream about it. And there's none of us that are in the militia community that will be surprised by it. There are none of you in the Patriot effort that should be surprised at it at all. Now, some will try to talk themselves out of it, and some will think they can make a deal. There are no deals with the devil. And when that happens, then all of the game plans, all of the nonsense the enemy's thought to plug in will be for naught. And then the sky's the limit. Because one of the things that everybody has learned by watching what has happened over the years is in this game, it's going to be use it or lose it. In other words, you make contact, you fire their hind end up, and you turn them into puddles of mush. You don't try to talk with them. You don't try to negotiate with them. You do what you have done before. Now, some of you are older gentlemen who were in World War II, and I know you can't dance the way we could, you know, in the past. I know that. But by God, you can still run a radio, and you know you can still drive a truck. Or you can at least help with men that are wounded or individuals that are hurt when the time comes and help to maintain the fabric of our society. But there's another group of veterans, the Korean War veterans, and guys, you're getting long in the tooth, too. You don't need to tell me. I know we got a lot of gentlemen in their 70s. And you know what? They're still online. And when the time comes, I don't care if you move fast. You pick the target, you put them down like the dog that they are with one round, and if all you did was take down that one black uniformed scumbag, you know what? That's one less we got to worry about. You pick the time, you pick the place, you neutralize the target. But there's a whole bunch of Vietnam vets, and there's a whole bunch of other people that are from other wars and other periods of time in the last 40 years, and you are more than competent, and you are more than capable, and you've seen men die, and you've seen men stacked like cordwood, okay? The other side, they always claim, and we got a bunch of goofs on our side that are doing the,
All right, here we go. So there we go. That's, you know, and basically, like he said, it would be small and mechanized in different sections around the country.
What happened. What did that man just say? Did he give you, was there a fact in there? Was there any advice? He talked a lot.
How could you nothing. How could you pinpoint an exact situation unless you're planning on doing something as a lone wolf or
it's too dynamic.
You know,
well, can't do that.
He's using
yeah.
But his brain is thinking in the same way everybody else's is. He kept saying one side versus the other side. It's not gonna be it can't be that way. It's gonna be
it won't start off that way, but it'll end up that way.
Whatever. So who's gonna win?
You can play devil's advocate all you want. Yeah, hang on. You can play devil's advocate all
I'm
you
not
want. And
devil's
that's
advocate.
What you,
hey,
well, if you
hey,
truly
I'm
believe
not playing
that,
devil's advocate. What
well,
makes you
then,
think I'm
well,
playing devil's advocate?
Well,
because
well,
you
look,
said you
look,
were not
look,
willing to
look,
die
look,
for
we
this country or
we, look,
that
look,
we have.
We cannot precisely chart out an event that has not happened yet, that is subject to an infinite number of variables in a dynamic situation.
Sarge,
it's impossible. All you can do is give a general idea of what might happen. That's all you can do.
I'll say it again. The United States government war games every single scenario every day. And if you don't think that they're war gaming, civil unrest,
okay.
You're
okay.
Study
okay.
Is like,
okay. I got news for you. Well, who provides logistical training for the United States Armed Forces? Who does it? Who does that?
I do.
How is that relevant?
Yeah, you do. The American taxpayer, the American people, for every member of the armed forces, there are 10 or 20 civilians that support them. Do you think every single one of them is going to go along with the military plan? Look, amateurs study tactics, professionals study logistics, and logistics are what keeps any war or any army going. And they, it's not like the other wars we fought where, you know, our forces can fight order overseas. This would be a fight on our soil against our own people. And there's no telling what side they're going to take.
I've spent the last 21 years.
Just say it loudly.
Hang on.
Now, I want to say it emphatically. You can respond to anything you want. You don't have to agree with me.
Guys, hang on. My guest was trying to say something. Go ahead, Ethan. Go ahead.
All I was going to say is that for the last 21 years, my entire life has been supporting the U.S. military. I have contacts from the highest echelon to the lowest levels across a huge percentage of the logistics components of the military. I've also dealt with the people at the point of the spear. And I was a combat vet myself. And I would argue that at least half of the U.S. military is not going to go along with it. That, yeah, you got a lot of woke people in the upper level leadership because they check the right boxes and they're singing the song. But I don't want to see a civil war. I don't believe we're so far gone that we don't have the opportunity to save it. And you are a defeatist.
You're not going to see one.
You're a defeatist. Why don't you go back to your beautiful home and your 2%? You're
well,
in Thailand.
You
you've already left.
You,
you've already left.
You have not.
You're not part of the argument.
You have not impugned any of my ideas. You just want to level ad hominem attack.
You haven't given an
Everybody
idea.
Everybody knows.
Not
as
one.
Soon as you.
When
every
Joe asks
yeah.
you what you stand for,
you,
what you think the war looks like,
as soon as
you haven't spoken
it,
a single word. All you've done is talk
Everybody
over people, knock down their conversations, and
yeah,
you are
yeah.
a surrender.
You lost already.
Yeah, you said you wouldn't die for any of us. You already said you wouldn't die for any of us.
I want to know one thing from the guy. Just let me have a few seconds here. For my own good and my own, whose side are you going to be on? So I know.
I'm not even there. If you listen, if you want to buy
That's the point.
Then I won't have to shoot at you. I won't have to shoot at you then, right? I'm easily identified because I'm black. I'm a black American. I love this country. So
ditto.
You won't be here. That means I can save ammo and not wasted on you.
I don't understand why you think we're making these unfair attacks on you when you specifically said and repeatedly you would not die for any of us or for this cause. You don't think it's worth it.
All right, give me a
reason.
Give me a reason why I should die. Sorry. Give me a valid reason. In fact, I would love
okay,
to.
Okay, let me give you a valid reason why. Let me give you a valid reason why.
No,
because for all of its faults and all of its corruption and all
yet.
Of its malfeasance, no country in the history of mankind has ever been formed on the noble propositions that this one was. Not one. And I think it is worth defending and trying to save. That's why. Now, if you don't think that's a good enough reason, then you don't have to go.
We lost it already. You lost. We didn't
well, I don't think
back.
We have. We're on the verge of losing it. We haven't lost it yet. I don't agree with that. I don't agree.
I don't agree with that. Either. I don't
Joe,
think
where are you
gonna anyone
get
on the phone line.
So you're going to get it back?
Saying the words.
Dick Gibson, the people your
saying
show
the words
attract,
that it's
man.
Lost
I
already.
Tell you, I'm going to have to give you a medal.
saying that we've lost already means that you're a defeatist and a surrenderer. And the rest of us aren't.
No, I see what's been going on since the 90s. None of us
right.
could have
so you've
imagined.
Already surrendered. You abandoned your country.
Have imagined.
You have no courage, and you ran away.
Look,
I ran
I
away.
I can understand. Look,
well,
I can
look
understand
it,
your despair. I understand why you're despairing. I'm not. You know, I'm not gonna. I'm not gonna. You know, get on you because that
so
you it's easy to be dismayed in a situation
you?
Like this. But the only reason to give up is because you're dead grave. There's no other reason
Sorry.
To give up.
Oh, my God.
All right,
Sorry.
Time out, guys.
Why
I'm kidding. I got one more call
time.
In here, guys. Let me get to real quick.
Why do we
Go
waste
ahead.
Time in these conversations?
Yeah, I know. I'm not gonna continue going over the same point over and over again. But let's see, the private caller, go ahead. We'll see what this is. Go ahead. I wonder. Go ahead.
Hello, Joe Gibson. What's up, man?
Yes, how you doing? We're wrapping up. We're getting ready to wrap up the end of the program here, but I appreciate you calling in, Mike, from Singapore. How you doing? Singapore. We were mentioning Singapore earlier, actually. So maybe that's why you were talking about it. This is another foreign call here. Go ahead. What's going on? What's on your mind?
Yes, sir. I want just to let you guys know that, you know, everything I predicted in your show, it came true. And Iran attack Israel, Israel attack Iran, but it's just drive on, and new attacks against Iran will come very soon, because after they get the money from United States, and Israel is ready to EMP attack Iran, and Ayatollahs will be in darkness, and there will be no light, there is no nothing works, so automatically the nuclear race would be going down for a couple of 2-3 years at least, if not more. So that's my prediction, and this is everything it has gone through yet, and Israel will attack Lebanon very soon. There's going to be, because they're very close to them. So if today
so you're saying they're gearing up for another attack right now? You're saying that Israel's gearing up for another attack right now? That's what you're hearing?
In the process of it, yes.
In the
suddenly.
Process, yeah.
You see that what happened? They sent the drones, and when the Ayatollah's air defenses were shooting left, right, then suddenly from the back, the missile came, hit, and killed all their air defenses for the nuclear facilities. So they show them, hey, we can do it. Don't F with us. But this is, you know, they sent 350 drones, missiles, whatever you can imagine. But all of them are a piece of shit anyway. So I told you that before, that, you know, if they don't have, they think they may have. But they don't.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Well, we know they're a little nuts over there.
Right.
I mean, but they don't hate America, though, right? The Iranian people don't hate America because they caught them on the media. I got a gentleman on right now who's in the transport business, Ethan. I wanted to ask him about that. The different people. The people over there overseas, how do they hate us Americans or they hate Western culture? Is that true? Or is it just a religious ideology?
Well, Vietnam don't hate Americans anymore because they're not the same people.
Of course.
Okay, Ethan?
He said the same thing that I told you for 100 times in your show, but you don't believe me.
Hang on. I'm asking my guest right now. Hang on. Mike, I got a guest on the line here. Hang on. I'm asking my guest here because he's been overseas. He's lived over in Iraq, actually.
So in Afghanistan, so I'm asking him, what are the consensus of the people, not the people in the political arena?
My experience in the widest majority of the countries that I went to, they're just like us. They want a better life for their families. They're focused on their jobs.
Exactly.
We're peripheral noise, and there's an extremist on either end of the scale, far left or far right, that don't like us. But in the vast majority of the places I've been in the world, there is not a strong level of hatred for the United States. Most people
Amen.
Are not involved, and they're not paying attention to the news.
Wow, God. Wow. Interesting.
Democrats hate the United States.
We got more people that hate us over here, huh?
Our biggest enemies are the folks here in the United States that have bought into the Marxist argument. And I would say one thing that it's tied to our guest from Singapore. There's a book called One Second After that was written by a colonel in the Air Force who war-gamed an EMP strike. North Korea smuggled in an ocean container ship into the Gulf of Mexico a nuclear weapon and launched it and created an EMP. If you haven't read it, it's worth reading. And he based
wow.
the book off of the war game that he did in the service. And interestingly enough, for those of us in North Carolina, it's based in Black Mountain, North Carolina. The story is.
Wow.
It's worth reading. I'm forgetting his name.
I mean,
they smuggling in parts for nuclear weapons one piece at a time coming across the border. How many pieces does it take? You have about 200 or 400 Chinese come across the border.
I go to the largest defense contract shows in the world, and Sarge has probably been to some, like the Association of the U.S. Army in Washington, D.C., or the Dubai military shows. And China has ocean container missile launchers that are disguised as ocean containers that pop open and are missile launchers. Like, these tools exist. They're out there. But our greatest enemy is not Russia. Our greatest enemy isn't China. Our greatest enemy is right here in our own country right now.
Yeah. All they need is a suit. Yeah, by the way, they don't need a big free rocket over ground or air-to-ground missile or ground-to-ground missile. All they need is a suitcase nuke. How big is that?
Yep.
Yes. You know, regarding this, the universities right now, everything is messed up. I mean, we see that PLO supporters and BLM and Antifa, and we can see that what the hell they're doing. I mean, they are very soon a new Antifa is coming to United States of America, and they will be called martial law in United States. This is crazy. This is, I mean, Jewish people cannot go to their own university. I mean, people cannot go to universities because, oh, the other ones, they keep hassling other people. I mean, if you are from Israel or you are from different background, etc., what the hell? So the PLO took over the whole university.
Well,
major universities.
Let me ask you a question. You had Jewish organizations that were supporting BLM, that was burning down cities, burning up the flags, taking down the statues of our heroes. That was Jewish organizations that were supporting them and giving them money.
No. I mean,
yeah, George Soros.
And I can name them.
Well, name away.
Yeah, that's our. Got a little disagreement with you on that one there. But Ethan, anything else you want to add here before I let you go? We're going to get ready to wrap it up here because Darren cut me off anyway, so I don't want to see him cut me off suddenly. I'm hoping
off.
You'll come back and come back again and I hope to have you back again soon, you know, or maybe I can have you like a co-host maybe, so you can help me moderate this crowd, you know?
Fat
chance.
I appreciate the opportunity to have a place to talk, and I think the fact that there's enough of us listening to a show like this when there are so many other shows just like this going on across the country gives hope to the fact that, like Sarge said, we don't know what the future is going to look like. My focus is on the things that I can change peacefully by getting more people involved locally. And if there's a handful of people in every county like me, and I know there is, I started a group here and we're at 200 people in less than 2 months, and we're growing at about 10% a week, that by the time the election rolls around, I have no question that we'll be at 1,000 people, and that's enough to change the direction of an election here for our school boards and for our local community, our supervisors. It may not shift the entire state, but if every county is doing it, it only takes people to stand up and do something.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely correct. And real quick, go ahead. I just want to ask some questions. Go ahead.
One of the key things you got to keep on the forefront is this. Do not compromise. If you sit down at the table with five quarters, goddammit, get up from the table with five quarters.
Amen, yeah. Sarge, you want to say anything here at the end here? I know you always got a mouth.
Yeah, definitely. I'll make it quick because I know you got a lot more things to say. Look, as long as linear reasoning, empiricism, rational thinking, and epistemology have any value whatsoever, as long as those things are true, we should be able to persuade anybody to our cause because our arguments are the best. That is the reason why they seek to destroy all of those things by making us actually argue about what is actually a woman. They are seeking to destroy all of that because they know they cannot prevail against us in any argument based on those factors that I just mentioned. And that's what we have to overcome. We have to do everything we can to convince these people. It is not in their best reason to give in to insanity and tyranny.
Sorry, tell them what you're
saying. My message is to everybody to have a unity and peace and love and respect to each other.
Oh.
Yes, we may have some differences, but
I don't know about all that, Mike. Mike, that's a good one to preach. I like that idea. You're right. That's a good idea to preach. But I forgot to ask Ethan, because he actually pays attention to the local politics here, and everyone knows I ran for public office on this podcast. What was when you said you did your research on me? What was your perception of how the media treated me? I mean, is that how they treat everybody, the newcomers, you think, or is that just me that they singled out?
No, frankly, I think anybody that is very clearly not part of the establishment, not part of the club, they're going to use whatever weapons they have available to them. You had, a 30-year-old bad decision as a kid that you've long since changed and invested in law enforcement for all those years. I think that they put into the news what they have the ability to put into the news to battle people. And it's something that's going to, if somebody's got any skeletons in the closet, they're going to use them.
Yeah, that's good advice.
The Chinese hacker took over the Texas water and messed it up in one of the cities in Texas already. So we are, it's better we have to be united, unity in diversity, and love each other, respect each other, regardless of our differences. Differences will be always there. Right now, Joe Gibson is in North Carolina. His guest is XYZ state, so there is nothing I can do. There is nothing we can do. So I know there is no political solution for today's issue, but still we have to be calm ourselves. We have to be in right-minded, and we have to, accept.
You got a good heart, Mike. You got a good heart, Mike. I'll give you credit. You got a good heart. I'll give you credit.
If the other side followed that philosophy, we will be talking about baseball scores right about now.
Amen. Amen.
Hey, guys, I appreciate you guys queuing in with me tonight. I do. Like I said, Ethan, you're great. Hopefully he'll come back again. Ethan's been listening to the podcast, so hopefully he'll come back. I'd like to, like I said, have him on once in a while. I know you said you travel half the time, half the month.
Yeah.
So,
come on back, Ethan. It was very enlightening. I really appreciate it, and I'm sure most everybody else
does. Yeah, I appreciate him, too, because he said everything very good and clear. And
I appreciate the opportunity, Joe, and the fact is, sometimes when I'm on the road, it's easier because I'm in a hotel room by myself, and it's easy to have a debate without keeping the baby up.
I hear you. I know you've been on for a while. Thanks.
Can I say one more thing before I go, Joe?
Yeah, go ahead.
And this is a tribute, actually. One of my favorite Revolutionary War characters at a lower rank was a retired captain named Samuel Whitmore. I'm sure Ethan knows who he was. He's 78 years old. He's retired. When the British were retreating out of Lexington and Concord after being harassed by all those militiamen, Whitmore was farming his fields, and he saw the relief brigade under General Earl Percy, Count Earl Percy, that was sent to assist the British Redcoats retreating. Whitmore got a hold to his musket, two dueling pistols, and a saber, and he ambushed the British grenadiers of the 47th Regiment of Foot from a stone wall. He killed one with his musket. He turned to his dueling pistols, killed a second grenadier, and fatally wounded a third. He then picked up the saber, charged the Redcoats, and slashed another one before they bayoneted him about 19 or 21 times and left him for dead. The guy revived, survived, and lived to die of old age at the age of 96. That is a man for you. That guy was tough as nails, and that's the kind of guy we need. 78-year-old man, survived, lived to be 96. He was a tough veteran in the French and Indian Wars, the King George's War, the War of Austrian Succession, Pontiac's War, and the American Revolutionary War. And, yeah, we need to remember guys like him.
Amen.
Thanks
Amen to that. All right, guys.
Okay.
Whatever it was.
Okay, everybody.
God bless the Republic. God bless the Republic. Take care.
God bless Israel. And